do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin?
Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanizes them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Katie.
And I'm Jade, and this is Future Setting. Today, I'm chatting with someone who I've wanted to talk with for a really long time, but for a whole lot of reasons, I haven't. And I'll be honest, it was the hardest conversation that I've had in the 80-odd Future Setting episodes. I was nervous before I began, and I suspected correctly that I didn't have the intellect or the gumption to hold the conversation as I'd hoped. So it spasmed in fits all over the place, and I lurched between intimidation and emotional fragility to a place of deep questioning and curiosity before, at the very end, he says, "I've been trying to get cancelled for ages and this interview might do it." So if that gives you any indication of how the conversation goes, you're probably spot on, but I would encourage you to persist. It is Tyson Yunkaporta. He's an Appalachian man who is an academic, researcher, an arts critic, and he's also the author of Sand Talk. It's an extraordinary reading experience. Like many of Australia's first peoples, he's a really complex identity and history, but it's this that gives him the authority to write and speak in a way which connects the wisdom of the past to the needs of the future. Although in this conversation he challenges this, bear with him. The way he thinks demands a longer-term perspective. He's both philosophical and practical, compassionate yet realistic. He's filled with humility and another worldly understanding of humanity. And in this conversation, he urges us to consider the non-linear complexity of the world, a world without hard and fast rules, time frames, and industrialized expectations. He challenges our expectations, points out cultural shortcomings, and invites us to recognize Indigenous concepts and their history. Importantly, though, he shows us how these patterns have the potential to be incorporated into our non-Indigenous thinking, which builds hope and possibility to benefit us all through the simple art of telling a yarn.
And like 12 cockatoos flew over a couple of days ago. Black cockatoos. I've never seen that many in Melbourne together in one place before. And I don't know, I wanted to follow them and I couldn't. I had to come in here and go on Zoom meetings, talking to people who are just constantly apologising but not giving anything back.
Mm. And I just want to leap to the fact that, you know, the thing that's right in front of us is the fact that things are dying. And it seems that despite the experts knowing about the impacts of climate crisis, that there was never going to be widespread action until global warming became experiential instead of conceptual. I've heard you talk a number of times with great passion but also serious frustration of the broken state of our education system, and I don't want to ask your thoughts directly on that, but I do want to refer to it through an idea that I'm still kind of formulating and refining with a bit of reading about our ability as a culture to navigate our way in our most animist state and without an intellectual lens. Can we do this? Is humankind up for this?
It's about just minimizing the amount of abstractions between you and the knowledge, the law that's in the land. Minimizing the amount of layers of abstraction between you and it. You know, and that first layer was, you know, the invention of abstract nouns to describe nature. You know, the invention of the word nature. It's the first abstraction, which makes us separate from nature. We're something else looking at the nature over here, and we're calling it this. So there's that name, and that's a layer of abstraction. So suddenly we have this illusion called the environment.
Yeah, the natural world.
The natural world, which is layered over the top. And then we have all these other abstractions and illusions like, economics, like economy, financial system, legal system, education, okay, all the institutions and their the abstractions, you know, knowledge.
Silos.
You know, the academy, yeah, study, all these
all
things.
All silos.
Yeah, so all these things are, you know, even just the idea, knowledge, you know, as an abstract noun, we don't need it, you know. So it's another layer of abstraction. So you've got this stack of illusions that's sitting on top of the landscape. We can't see the landscape anymore. It's because we're not supposed to. We're kept off it. And there's not any walls around it and fences around it to limit our access to these places. And even if you climb over those, then, you know, you will be arrested for trespass. You will go to jail. It's illegal. You know, the land is, we're not supposed to be on it because that's not land anymore. That's capital. And so there's that financial layer of abstraction. So, you know, it's so wide, can't get over it, so low, can't get under it. You can't get around it. You know, it's all these enclosures, you know, to make land into capital that can be leveraged against debt, so that the money on money return bloody financial system is there, so that a handful of people can gain wealth and time without having to work for it because their money's working for them. And that's all it is. And it's just a matter of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And Peter is fucked. Peter is the rock. That's what that Peter name means. Peter's the rock, the ground, the earth. You know, Peter is the people, the community, the everything that this system is built on. And Paul's getting fat and Peter's dead now. You know, Paul's looting his corpse. You know, that's how Paul's being paid. And Peter and all of his descendants are now on the hook. You know, it's robbing from the future of people as well. So it's this illusion, this grand magic trick that's been done of all these abstractions. And we are finished. We're finished under this, you know. So, you know, I can't even remember your original question. That's how complicated it is, even to just name it. It's like, you know, it takes 20 minutes and you lose track of what you were saying in the first place. It's inexplicable.
Does it feel like if we're done and someone's getting fat and someone's dying before our very eyes, a potential way through that crisis, because it's nothing short of a crisis, is to re-indigenize. But so I use that as a word that.
Well, the word's ruined. So, yeah. You know, you saying it is like, is awful. It's terrible. It makes you a bad person because of what that means. But I feel you, what you're talking about. I feel you about what you know you need to do, but there isn't a word for it. So you have to use that. And it makes you look like a dickhead. You know, there's no way we can talk about it without looking like dickheads.
Mm.
So I say, let's just go for it, look like dickheads for a minute. Look, yeah, this last night I was talking to, so I don't know. Could you go to Holland? Could you go to Holland and learn about, you know, connecting, reconnecting?
I don't know if it's just about the place, though, and I've also heard you.
No. I'm not telling you should go to Holland. I'm just saying, would that be possible? And it's like, well, that's ridiculous. That's a modern state, and it's either agricultural land or it's bloody city, and it's all supposed to be underwater except for there's walls. And so, what the hell could I learn about nature there?
Yeah.
Well, and that's just an example. A yarn that I had last night. There's a Frisian fellow from there, and Frisian people are the indigenous people of the Netherlands. A lot of people never heard of him, you know, and he's talking to me about his traditional knowledge around fire stick land management, like burning country there. And because I'd recommended Victor Stephenson's book to him and he read it and he's like, oh yes, we got this. This is my grandfather, my great grandfather. This is their law. The practices that they told me, we got this with the heather. And I can't do his accent, but oh my God, it was amazing. And he's like, it's the entire thing. He said, you know, almost one for one match, you know, with the complexity with Victor Stephenson's work around the, you know, all the amazing complex system that's involved just with fire country management in Australia. You know, all the different really complex parts of that ecosystem, it's right there. And it's still in living memory in the folklore of that place and in the practices of a lot of people, you know, right there in Holland. and he's talking to me. So we're talking as two Indigenous people from the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, talking about the same kinds of things. And, you know, and I'm finding clues in there. And I'm like, so I ask him about salamanders because I heard that story. And I know that myth, you know, is lore usually, and it's not just literal. It's not literal. There's knowledge in there. So I asked him, well, what's the thing about salamanders and fire then? I've heard that fairy tale, you know, that I don't know if you've ever heard that, but that mythology around salamanders, you know, being able to just crawl through the fire kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this idea that that's part of, I don't know, fantasy folklore, you know, magical creatures sort of rubbish. And he's like, oh, no, that's a real thing. You know, yes, it's not true that they're fireproof, but, you know, it's a seasonal indicator. Oh, my God. So it's a seasonal sign that you have to follow the right signs when the right thing's flowering, when the seeds are ready, seed banks ready to be activated in the heather and in certain parts of the forest, and these mushrooms have started doing their thing, and then this is flowering. That's when you burn this part. And when you burn this part at exactly the right time, when all those other indicators are lining up, then that's a signal for the salamanders to come up out of the ground, out of hibernation. So that lore, that L-O-R-E, that folklore, that story, that what you call mythology, it actually carries lore for how to care for country. Now, that's part of the Western canon. That's part of the European canon of folklore. There is... Don't tell me you got no story. Don't tell me you got no pattern. You know, this fella, just from listening to his great-grandfather and just from going around the countryside, sitting down with the elders, you know, in his place, you know, these are all farmers and stuff like that. He's sitting down and he's finding the old stories. And, you know, he's putting together, it's easy. The pattern's there. All of the pattern's there and he's living it. He's living every single part of it. It's not hard. It's there. And I guess it's different for a settler, you know, like if he was living in Australia, it would be a different thing. But I don't see why he couldn't bring exactly the same process, exactly the same methodology and process of inquiry, that he couldn't bring that here into his dialogue with the people of the land where he's from. And would that have to be that every single person has to consult one-on-one with an elder to do it? They're already completely overbooked and really exhausted, being consulted on every single tiny little thing. You know, it's not. I should only have to consult with one person, and that person can talk to, like, you know, 50 people from their own community and spread them like that. That's where we're up to. We're up to it needs to be done. It needs to be done now. Everyone needs to come back under the law of the land. That way, start to understand the patterning of coming into a seasonality, a time, place understanding of where they are and what it takes to be a custodian, a custodial species, re-inhabiting our ecological niche, because the land needs us. Because the other thing that Michelle said, this detachment, was that the salamanders are dying out. They're dying out because the people are no longer burning in that place now. And because they're no longer burning, the signal to come up from hibernation isn't going to the salamanders. So only a few of them are coming up every year, you know, and so every year it's less and less, and soon there'll be no salamanders at all because humans are not doing their right thing in the ecological niche for that place.
And that story can be replicated across any land and in any place and
exactly
and in any way.
It's the same pattern. We don't have salamanders in Australia. So if you've got salamander story in your culture, that's good story. You know, and that might only apply specifically to a species in the Northern Hemisphere, but your methodology for working that story and understanding place and seeing the pattern and reading the landscape and coming into dialogue with the landscape and the people of the land, that's still right there and it's still valid. So, you know, bring that. If you're coming to the table going, oh, I'm white, I'm ignorant, I don't know anything, I really defer to your wisdom, you know, and I'm just here to listen, you know, but at the same time, silence is violence. I recognize that. Silence isn't an option. It's just like it's all bullshit. We haven't got time. We just haven't got time.
So it is about identifying and owning our patterning instincts. But
yeah,
I know, and you said a minute ago, one, we haven't got time, and you also said it's actually relatively easy because it's an innate thing in all of us. But actually I would argue that for a really long time the Western world's been trained to think in siloed reductionist columns, and our inclination to do this is now thwarting our ability to see ourselves and everything around us in cohort with those patterns. And this sort of
I'd say a century ago, most of you were still living in profound relationship with the landscape.
Yeah, maybe not even. Maybe 60 or 70 years ago. Maybe it's only two or three generations, but it is enough for there to have been a gap. And also the dominance of technology in our existence makes me wonder whether or not we have gone too far or whether or not we can actually climb ourselves out of this.
Mm.
I followed Artist's family for a long time, and we've interviewed them on here. And among many things, I was really struck by their ability to embrace their humanness, their non-mechanizedness, and the pace and the expectations. And you know, as you've just spoken about, their patterning instincts and their willingness to lean into that and to formulate their life around that. You know, and then re-listening to them during the editing phase, I found myself in this kind of deep thinking phase and longing to live the way they do, but it's just so bloody hard to detach yourself from the world that we're swimming in and, you know, the overwhelm of the relentless white noise that is shoved down our throats, even if you actively try and step away from that. So, you know, what does that need to look like? If we need to connect with our patterning instincts and we need to really see ourselves.
Well. Yeah, well, especially, I mean, you're going through a period of history where authoritarianism is looming large, left and right. It doesn't matter where you are or what end of the political spectrum is currently in power. Authoritarianism is the order of the day. And it's because the actual system that those are supporting and the structures within that system, you know, that all politics serves, that all policy serves, et cetera, et cetera. It's because... It demands that people are unable to do that. It demands that people are unable to move out of the places they're zoned into and unable to access the landscape, because that real estate needs to be leveraged and leveraged a little bit more, because it's starting to get really hard to stop the bubble from bursting with this lander's capital. You know, they don't want it to burst yet. You know, it has to be able to keep inflating because the whole thing's sitting on that. That's what everything rests on. And, you know, so basically in the end, the structure of the system demands authoritarianism. Our movement is going to be increasingly curtailed. Our speech is going to be increasingly curtailed. The activities that we're going to be able to do in terms of growing our own food, educating our own kids at home, anything that you do autonomously or independently, or that's self-determining in any way, is going to be shut down more and more. This is just the period of history that we're living through. So, and that doesn't mean, oh, everyone despair, or it doesn't mean, oh, we need a revolution. It just means notice that. And I guess, how do you keep that stories alive? How do you keep that pattern going? And how do you quietly get on with the realities of mutual aid, which is the real human economy, which is the real human governance model that's patterned into every single one of us as a primate? Mutual aid is how we work, and that's in the law of the land. We all feel it, and when we let ourselves flow with that and with each other in the right way, that's what happens. Now, how do we maintain that in the tiniest corners that are left to us, the tiniest corners that are escaping the notice of a massive surveillance state? They want to make sure, I guess, that... that anybody who is not keen to re-enter whatever kind of world it is that they're reopening up and is happy to continue with the innovative structures that they've put in place with their local food co-ops that they've developed over COVID, where there's a whole heap of networked permaculture gardens and a very local food chain set up that's looking quite resilient, et cetera. You know, all of these things, you know, they do come under, so I guess the technical name for that is mutual aid activism. I mean, it's really just people helping each other out, but that's now, that's called mutual aid activism now. And that has its, and so that
it's collectivism at its core.
Yeah. So that it has its roots in anarcho-communism from the early 1900s. So, you know, therefore it is the enemy, and a lot of, mutual aid. So mutual aid is not about throwing bombs. Mutual aid is about making sure everyone's fed. It's about groups of people getting together to help each other out, and then to help out people who aren't being sheltered, clothed, educated, fed, to make sure that happens. So I'm talking to a fellow from South Africa the other night, and he was talking about exactly the same things that you're talking about. Oh, what can we do to, you know, make all these like, you know, local things happen, and we're having local people are getting together and putting together their own systems for their own power grids, you know, that's running on sustainable energy, free sustainable energy. And, you know, and we're getting, directing this water in, and we're doing our own irrigation, and we're regenerating the land, and people are starting to be healthy on the land. We're doing that. And I say, yep, that's good, but that won't last long. Anybody who's doing that becomes Libya. Anybody anywhere in the world who's doing that. So if you're doing that in Brisbane here, you are Libya, and they will come. You know, you will be assassinated on YouTube. I mean, I'm exaggerating there, obviously. It's hyperbole.
The power of social media is an assassination at times.
But you will be shut down. Suddenly there'll be a brucellosis scare, or, you know, that's what happened to. So in my hometown, when that happened, when we were running our own pastoral lease company and keeping our own cattle, and so we were actually, we said no to welfare because we had our own business, and it was a community, you know, company, and the funds were distributed for everybody. Oh, my God, communism. So the government declared a brucellosis scare and shot all of the cattle from a helicopter to shut down, you know, that business, and then started a massive program of welfare to train us up to, in order to, you know, learn how to start one day maybe engaging with the free market economy. God damn it, we were. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but just not playing by the rules, not playing by the political rules.
But you can't. No, you're not so – your engagement with the economy is about extraction. Your engagement with the economy is you die, we take your bauxite. All right? Shut up. Have a drink.
And nothing more I said.
Only don't have a drink, because that's bad. But do.
Well, don't, because the water's owned by someone else.
Yeah.
I feel like the reality that we're facing, this climate crisis that's before us, and this crisis of culture, or this vacuous culture that isn't holding us but kind of needs to, is irrelevant. But it seems that political corruption really is at the heart of all of it, and I'd argue that that's still the key obstacle, and it's formidable, and it's presented in a way which is inaccessible. So what does the General Joe do?
Okay, here's the thing. It's not about a few bad apples, and it's not about weeding out corruption. You know, basically there are horrendous things that need to be done that are baked into the structure of this system. That stack of abstractions that I was talking about before over the landscape, that is systemic, and in any system there is a structure. Baked into the structure is the need to kill people. It's the need to have a caste system where increasing numbers of people are missing out so that things can be priced. Things can only be priced if they're limitable and excludable. Needs to be more and more people missing out all the time. Needs to be massive amounts of displacement, marginalization, extraction, destruction of the environment in order for economies to keep growing. That's baked in. Corruption is just a way to service that need. You could weed out the corruption, but then it would happen some other way. It must, because that's the structure of a growth-based economy.
So ultimately, capitalism and growth.
You know, it's not even just capitalism, because communism does exactly the same thing. That's a growth-based economic system that demands the destruction of land. It demands continuous growth. You know, it's exactly the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. I'm not even talking about that. You know, it's finance. You know, there's nothing wrong with a free market economy. It's finance that stuffs this up. It's that magic trick. It's having land as capital. If land was inalienable and it could not be foreclosed on to secure a debt, things would change quite significantly. If there was no such thing as interest, things would change quite significantly. These are structural things that are built into the system, but there's a lot more things. They demand inequality. So inequality is not coming because you're evil, because you're white and you can't help yourself. Inequality is not happening because of people's just innate sense of privilege and white supremacy or any other kind of supremacy. It's not because, one gender is like, inescapably patriarchal. Climate change, the Anthropocene is not because humans are innately evil and must destroy their landscape. You know, that's not our patterning. You know, we are having to act within a system that demands that we act in certain ways. You know, humans don't naturally have to dispose of heaps of packaging that's destroying the ocean. You know, we don't do that. We only learned how to do that. We were trained how to do that bloody 50 years ago. And that's a whole other story. It was quite deliberate. And it was basically to make make another layer of production in the supply chain to be subsidized. You know, it really clunky. It ends up costing more money. But weirdly, in the system of global finance, it makes people more money if they own the rails, you know, from A to B within a supply chain. So the reason the supply chains are so clunky is because it makes people money. So, you know, the amount of oil that has to be burned and water that needs to be wasted and plastic that needs to be created to get an apple to you is just insane. It's like three lifetimes worth of energy of one person just so you can have a piece of fruit. You know, that's not good energy return on energy investment, you know, but in the financial sort of thing where value is stripped and stolen from everything, you know, they're making, someone's ends up making a ridiculous amount of money off that one apple, getting it to you. And it's all subsidized from elsewhere. And there's massive layers of like derivatives and ridiculous speculation and just nasty tricks and wealth transfers and bailouts and bloody everything else that occurs along that ridiculous thing. Now, you know, there was this myth with COVID that, oh my God, when COVID struck, and we all locked down in our houses, so we weren't polluting anymore. You know, we weren't driving around in our cars, and oh my God, all the skies cleared, and there was no more pollution, and everything changed. It's bullshit. I think it was about 6 to 8% reduction. So when we stopped doing all our human things, just the big clunky industry, even though the supply chains were all disrupted, just all of the industrial machinery still in place still produced about 92 to 94% of all exactly the same amount of emissions and stuff that was going on before. We're not doing it. Our selfish showering and eating and sheltering is not killing the freaking planet. It's not. There's a handful of assholes doing it. And at the moment, there's a structure there and we're ignoring the structure because at some stage, you know, in the last 30 to 40 years, all of our thinking got directed to the text, you know, to discourse. There's nothing outside of the text. All we do is we look at the discourse because that's where the power relations are. If we change the word, we change the reality. That's where all of our, I mean, in Indigenous academia as well, we made the same mistake. You know, we focused on discourse. We focused on semiotics. You know, we focused on basically critique. Critiques of power in art, literature, media, things like this, the expressions of power that are in that. If you could change that, then you're changing the reality, but really not because the structure is still there. Critique is part of the structure. It's a commercial enterprise that is now part of the structure. You know, we need to move away from the post-structuralism and get back to some kind of structuralism where we're looking at systems and the structures in them, and we're looking at changing or pulling down those structures and, you know, allowing regenerative ones to emerge.
Are we actively failing, or are we inactively or apathetically ignoring? They're quite different.
I just think that's your choice. They both have the same outcome. So the system doesn't really care which one you take. But you know, each of us is led. I mean, that's the end point. of each of us, of any activity that we undertake, any activism, any resistance, any learning, any personal growth, always ends up in one or two of those places, you know, futility or despair. it's where everything's directed to, like, I don't know. So they're going to fight us now on the idea of defunding oil subsidies, because it's fossil fuel industries, massive subsidies that prop them up, because they run at a loss otherwise. So the idea is, if we could just stop subsidizing oil, so we're going to fight for that for most of the next decade. And probably in the end, if we all burn our lives on that project, after about a decade, we'll win that.
But we've been hugely distracted from...
Yeah, for a start, I mean, it's exactly the same way as we've been fighting to have people recognize that climate change exists.
Yeah.
To try and convince a bunch of people who already know it exists but are lying, we've spent the last two decades trying to win that argument against them. That's what we've done instead of actually acting to mitigate it. We've just tried to win the discourse war, win the culture war over whether or not climate change is happening. Stop looking at the things.
And look at what instead?
Look at the relations. Look at the relational patterns, the actual cause and effect relations of what's going on. Look at the structures within the systems. If you can see the system, and then you can see the structures within that and all the relationships that are going on there, then you'll understand where you need to act to make emergence of regenerative structures happen. And they're in quiet places, and please don't talk about it on Facebook. Don't let anyone know you're doing it, because you are Libya and you will be, you will be taken down. And it'll be, I mean, so in Australia, it'll be a soft assassination. It's not, you're not going to get bayoneted up the butt on YouTube like Gaddafi was. But, you know, it'll just be like, pedophile activity suspected in permaculture community. It could be that. That's a bit extreme, but that's real easy. That takes nothing. That takes one tweet from one infiltrator who never even had to step into the garden. You know, it's very easy to destroy any little movement that you want to make. Just quietly get on with it with your neighbors, and then quietly syndicate your neighborhood with other neighborhoods, and don't go, wow, look what we're doing. Okay, the Kurds in northern Syria are not advertising the like amazing stuff that they're doing, because somebody, they have to govern themselves, because the actual state that owns them is too busy fighting with the other state that owns them. So they're basically just left there, well, how are we going to do sanitation, education, medical, all this sort of stuff? How will we organize our municipal lives? And they just do it. They do it, and it's not glamorous work, so nobody really particularly wants to do it. So people are put forward to do it, because it's all admin work and it's hard. So they do it for as long as they can, maybe a year, and then they nominate someone else. And basically that happens in this street, on this neighborhood, and then that, and then it scales up to the municipality, and then there's a federation of municipalities with no one in charge. You know, it's people who are on a rotating basis doing the hard job of administrating impossible circumstances, who are then coming together, for regular meetings, you know, at the level where it starts to scale up in the syndication. But there are 3 million people living well under that right now. That's Kurds. That's what people do. Nobody knows about it. I mean, as soon as people find out about it, that place is going to get the crap bombed out of it. So I probably shouldn't be talking about it over a goddamn podcast. So if you're under any illusions that you know, there's some way that communism is better than capitalism, is better than fascism or whatever, it's just bullshit. They're like three threads in one rope that's wrapped around our necks, you know, and anytime we actually seek to recover our human patterning outside of this bullshit system of nation building that's only a century old, anytime we want to step out of that and back into our bioregional identities and ways of living as human beings, anytime we do that, we're finished.
Yeah.
They will come together and smash us.
Can I use that as a slight segue into something that's a slightly different pace?
Yeah.
The Tao, which is, you know, the belief system that structures or symbolizes the sense of the way as the right or proper way of existence in the context of attainment of the full coming into being. It's this, you know, the Western word is your intuition, being led, I guess, by your intuition. But it's more than that because it, you know, it doesn't really have the ability to have words wrap around it because that just minimizes it. But do you think that, you know, even sitting here now trying to intellectualize this, our desire to mechanize and to intellectualize things is actually our greatest fault ultimately?
Well, yeah. You know, everything's industrialized. So, but activism is an industry. So as I was saying before, all of our efforts are being directed and redirected into these horrendously futile culture wars. You know, and so I'm not telling people to just do nothing or to lose hope. It's just see that there's a system, see that there's a structure, and that fighting culture wars doesn't change it at all. In fact, it helps the structure. It helps to keep reproducing the structural inequality of the world. You know, find another way. Look for – it's just about looking and seeing that that's not working and that that's not the way to go. And the way is going to be what? Oh, so Tyson, tell us your solution. Well, what's the way? Well, it's like, well, that's for you to find. That's what the Tao is. You know, every person's expression of the Tao, every person's story, you know, is, it's not their individual expression of it, but each person does have a unique web of relationships. And that your network is quite different from anybody else's on the planet, your specific set of relations. You're nothing special in and of yourself, and neither am I. But our fingerprint in this world is our web of relations. Now, that web of relations, therein lies your way. I can't tell you what that is. But when we sit together, the stories that you tell me, if you're speaking true story and not wrong story, then your story is coming from your patterning of relations. And my story is coming from my patterning of relations. They come together and they really do enrich things. That's regenerative, the knowledge that comes out of there. You know, I don't want to keep harping on about it, but my conversation with the Dutchman last night, you know, my Brolga story alongside his Crane story was very, very productive. And it was talking up, you know, our regenerative symbiosis that was really ended up looking at the mechanics of that and what you need to do to make those happen. So, okay, so for example, this is a really good one. He was talking about they were reintroducing an extinct bird species. They're bringing it over from Sweden. You know, but its habitat was the heather. But he said, no, that's the wrong way around. That's not how you restart that symbiosis with the heather. You know, because the heather is ill. The heather's sick now because it hasn't been being burned. So you put those birds there and they're all going to die. So even with the rising and falling of the pH levels of the seasonal bird activities and then the seasonal burning, you know, with that not happening, that's enough to kill the birds. So all you need to, but the birds get brought in seasonally with the smoke. So all you need to do is burn the heather again in the right way. And then the land will bring the birds in. The birds will smell the smoke and they'll come in. So the Tao is never a direct intervention way. It's never, okay, there's a gap here, so we will address those social determinants and close that gap. Nothing is ever that direct.
It's not that lineal.
Yeah. You need to be able to see the system, see the symbioses at work, the positive feedback loops, but also the negative feedback loops that regulate things so they don't get out of control.
And the cyclical continuity.
That's it. But you need to see how each symbiosis is interlocked with other symbioses there so that you know where the intervention needs to happen.
Mm.
So he was talking about making space in the barn for these owls. not like catching owls and bringing them in, but making space in the barn for these owls and then doing something very specific with these cows and about where to spread their manure. And that triggered a particular sequence with the rodents, the owls, and the grass that come up from that, then coming into burning this area over here, which then that particular smoke brings these birds in. And and then the action of these reptiles in the next, it was just like boom, 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 boom. It comes like that. And where's the intervention there? Where is the point of intervention? Was it the cows and the manure? Was it, you have to be like a symbiosis. You never know where the start, where the end is. You don't know where the direct pressure point is, but you need to just be across all of that system as a custodian and making it work.
And I don't know if you can be across such incredible depths of detail if all you do is intellectualize it. I feel like if you haven't got the ability to really connect with the patterning that exists around you, then we've kind of lost before we've started.
Well, that's why we have story, and that's why we have ceremony. That's why we have ceremony. That's why we have ritual. That's why we have what people have abstracted into what they call arts, the arts now. This is another layer of abstraction that destroys us because it means we can't do our real thinking and our real meaning making anymore. Arts is something that wasn't named before, that until art became capital, it was something that every human did every day to make sense of the world around them and to understand their role in the system and what needed to be done next. Collectively, every human being does that, but we're not allowed to do that anymore. It's like land that's taken from us. It's a few geniuses who are allowed to do it. And if you're trying to do it and you're not one of those selected geniuses, you know, within the marketplace, then you'll starve as an artist.
And look, really, that's what the however many pages are in here, 275 pages of Sand Talk is about. And there was a level of grief that sat in me as I read this, and it, you know, it was for all those things that you referred to before, but it was also for the fact that I don't know that we've got the capability to relearn a way of communicating that is not linear. You're saying here, I want to just read something that you said here. I can't find my page, it's always the way. A collection of pages filled with marks representing speech sounds is a complicated way of communicating, particularly when you want to convey a practical sense of the pattern of creation that might shed light on current crises the world is facing. Complicated, not complex. They are two very different things. So there's a few things in there. One, I would love to unpack the difference between complicated and complex, but also how do we find our way, and is it just that patterning and it's that deep connection with what's going on around us and our role in that, to find a way of storytelling that doesn't have to use words, because there's so much more to the world around us than the way we reduce it to words.
But, yeah, story is in – yes, there's story that has – that's in words. That's good. That's good story. But story goes in a lot of ways. Story goes in image, story goes in dance, story is in song. But all of these things are not story unless they have place. So the goose that laid the golden egg is good story. You know, people from the Northern Hemisphere should be living by that story. That's a story about regenerative systems. The goose that laid the golden egg. And it's a cautionary tale about what happens, the futility of extraction. You know, it's a really good story. The only problem is it's only a tale. It's not a story. It should be a good story. What it's missing is place. Nobody can tell me where the mountain is. That is the goose's body. Nobody can tell me the river where his blood, you know, ran. Nobody can tell me that big stone that was the last egg and where that lays. You know what I mean? No one can show me how that story, then that song line, then links up to Jack and the Beanstalk song line, which is another cautionary tale about economic and financial systems.
So is that just interpretation of story?
No, it's not interpretation of the story. It's expression of law, and the law is in the land. The law of how to live, which even just the laws of physics would do, to come under the laws of physics that are in the landscape, that would be enough. The law is expressed in the land. And the paths that you find through that are narrative pathways. There are stories in the landscape, and you can follow them. If there is a waterway, there's a songline along that anywhere in the world. You walk along that, that place will have a story, it'll have a message for you. And there'll be points along in that story where infinite knowledge is preserved, and it'll also be replicated in the stars in different seasons as that knowledge becomes particularly pertinent. Different layers of it are revealed in different seasons as different things along that songline do different things. And the reflected one in the sky camp and the stars above are doing their things. This is everywhere, and everybody had this until very, very recently. You know, it's been a cataclysm of forgetting, and it needs to be recovered. Not exactly word for word, because revitalization is not about that. I guess you can look at the history of the Celtic revival, because all the old Irish law was lost, remember? But there were little bits and pieces left. There was enough of the language left and enough people who spoke bits of it for them to put that all back together again and spend a few decades in revitalization and reclaim their land-based knowledge system in Ireland. you know, Wales, same thing, except they had kind of more continuity. And, you know, you got dialogue across between different regions like that that are similar, and you can fill in each other's blanks too. And it's through dialogue that we cobble things together. You might have lost something, but this mob over here still has it. So we talk, we syndicate, we do it like that. That's what we need to talk about, not talking about politics of abstraction and more abstracts and, you know, which political system's better, capitalism or communism. Let all these people who are pecking over the carcass of the earth like crows right now, let them have those cultural wars. The rest of us need to get on with actually building regenerative cultures, cultures of transition through this Anthropocene, the cultures that are going to survive the thousand-year cleanup that we're all going to be on from now forward. You know, we need to be doing that work, and it needs to be happening now. We need to quietly get on with it, and we need to make sure it doesn't have a name. As soon as it has a name, it'll be co-opted. Someone will want to throw funding at it while we're throwing money. If you've got a budget, then what you're doing is bullshit. If you've got funding, what you're doing is not the thing. You know, that's not the thing. If it has a name, if it's something with a hashtag, if it's something where you have followers, it's not anything. You know, what you need to build is relationships, not brands. Not brand recognition. That's not relation. That's not right relation. That's illusion. It's a bad relation. It's a bad story. The tales that you carry have to have a place in them again. So the stories have to be grounded in place. Find that mountain that's the goose from the golden egg story. Make that happen again.
We all need to find our own, but collectivism needs to dominate.
Look, I tell you, it's right there. You would have thought that you know, most of like industrialized Europe, you know, after, you know, just centuries of just getting flogged and invaded and wars and wars and wars over and over and over again, you'd think it'd be gone. But, you know, I talk to people in Europe who still have the law of the land. They still have that from their great grandparents and their grandparents. It's still freaking there. You know, settlers have been in Australia for like 2.5 centuries. You know, there's enough shared knowledge there. There's enough to build a relation on, just quietly with people. And I don't know. I don't think everybody needs to join, you know, the way of speak. I'm finding it hard to get down to it. I'm finding it hard to get down to the real yarns and the real exchanges with settlers in Australia at the moment, because 70% of their speech is disclaimers about how shitty they are and how badly they feel about being this shitty person that belongs to this shitty culture, and, you know, and we're so sorry, and I want to hear your voice and all that. I'm like, oh, man, well, I want to hear what you actually have to say. You know, I there's knowledge that you have that I need. Like, I want to find out, you know. I need to find out about tractor maintenance right now, and all you're doing is fucking apologizing to me about how shitty you are and how I'm sure you know heaps more about tractors than me. You know, you've been here for 40,000 years. Whatever, man. Just tell me how to fix my fucking tractor. It's like, can we just skip to it? I don't have a tractor, by the way. I was just using that as an example.
I have to laugh, though, because...
Like, can we get to it? I'm just sick of it. Can I just ask settlers, just do what you need to do on Twitter and in your poxy meetings, but when you're talking to me and it's just us, can you just
answer
fucking
the bloody
drop
question.
It and get down to business? Because I'm sick of it. It's just, it's boring. And you don't have to throw that lens, that masochistic, self-flagellating lens onto everything. If you meant it, then you'd be surrendering your capital. You'd be paying the rent. Are you going to pay the rent? Stop acknowledging country to me. You're not willing to make a verbal contract to look after me and to give me mutual aid. You know, so this week I have to send money to family, and there's, you know, a massive crisis going on in the family. So that's all gone, you know, all my money's gone. So what if I run out of food this week? Who am I going to talk? I'm going to talk to this white person who's going to fucking apologize to me and tell me how terrible they feel about, like, all of their privilege and, oh, but you're so wise and I'm not. I don't know anything because I'm only white. I'm useless. And it's like, dude, you're delivering a parcel. Just give me the fucking parcel. Yeah. And then, but it's like, are you, I don't know. So you, you got two houses? You're a parcel delivery boy and you inherited two houses from your uneducated parents. Who were, only one of them worked here. What did he do? He held a stop sign in a mine. Okay. And you have two fucking houses off the back of that, you know, just off the back of that effortless, lazy ass privilege in the workers' paradise that was built off of the back of stealing stuff from Aboriginal land to sell to China for a bit. And now you're being rude to China and suddenly they're not going to buy your shit anymore and you won't know what to do. And you'll be coming around with you. You'll have two houses. I'll be on the street, and you'll board up one of your houses because you're not using it. And at the same time, you'll be passing me on the street and telling me how sorry you are and how much better I am than you because you're amazing. Oh, the longest lived culture on the planet. You know. Oh, I'm really humbled by this, and I have a lot to learn. You know. And I'm just going to be quiet. I'm going to be quiet and center your voice. I'm going to center your voice and let you speak. But at the same time, I won't remain silent because silence is violence. Silence is fucking violence. It's like, can you shut up? Can you shut up and take your latte somewhere else and just shut up? Or sit down and just fucking talk to me? Yeah. Like, can we do... Anyway, I've been trying to get cancelled for ages. I think this will do it. It's for book sales. You sell heaps of books when you get cancelled.
Oh, fuck. Tyson.
Yeah. I'm going to Jordan Peterson this fucker and buy some land back.
I'll be really honest with you. I wanted to interview you at the get-go from this pod series, but, fuck, I just didn't think I'd be able to hold my own with you and your level of freaking intellect. And
well, as you can see, it's all over the place like a mad chook.
Well, I thought I might be able to keep up with that, but I just, you know.
It's not particularly highbrow or anything, is it?
Well, you've had me confused. You've had me in tears. You've had me laughing, really laughing. And now we might both get...
Have you ever wanted to punch me in the face?
I didn't want to punch you. Not at any point did I want to punch you. I'm impressed that your children haven't... yelled at some point. We've managed to do a whole 1 hour and 9 minutes and there's been no interruption.
Well, that means they're currently destroying their mother.
Or the lounge room or the backyard or whatever the hell kids like to destroy. I don't even know what to say. I need to listen to this a couple of times more because there's so much in there. And
yeah. And it's very confused. Look, it's like, there is no wisdom here. Like, honestly, I'm a young fellow. I haven't got my shit together at all. You know, I don't have any answers. I don't have solutions. But I just know that there aren't. I know that interventions don't work. I know that direct action doesn't work. you know. I know that anything.
So what the fuck does?
I don't need you to have the answer to that.
Yeah, like, it's not what
it's
I'm really
in the stories.
Asking.
It's stories are the only thing that convey it. And I was trying to sort of tell you, maybe to listen to the yarn between. So it's up on the podcast, The Other Others, and the episode. That's the podcast for my lab, the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Lab at Deakin. And the episode, it's the most recent one at the moment. It's called Jumpstarting Stalled Symbioses. Now, I just think it's really cool, but I think in the end it comes back. All right, I'll leave you with this one. It comes back to what Victor Stephenson says, and the Dutch fellow said the same thing. Don't plant trees. So we look at carbon, we look at deforestation, we look at, you know, erosion, and we go, oh, direct action, plant trees. We're all going to plant trees. Oh, they won't let us plant trees. They're coming to fight the people who are cutting down the trees. Fight the people who stop us from planting trees. Plant trees, force them to plant trees. Every time they sell a sneaker, they have to sell a tree. We've won the Green Revolution. No. You know, Victor Stephenson says, don't plant trees. You don't know where the fuck to put a tree. You know, you're a human being. You don't know the right place to plant a tree. Country knows where to. Country grows trees, and it knows where to put them. You know, you had one job. You had one fucking job. Burn country in the right place at the right time. Just burn country in the right place at the right time. That will bring in the birds. It'll bring in the seeds, and they'll be in the right place. Country will select the right soil, the right thing, the right plants to grow in those. Country takes care of itself. All you have to do is burn it properly in the right season. That's all you have to do. And walk around and notice it and be a custodian in a custodial niche. As you're walking through, you'll see what else you need to do. You know, the places you're attracted to in different seasons to get the things you need, the mushrooms or whatever else, you will piss in those places, and you'll provide things that the trees or the plants need in that place. You'll dispose of, you'll leave different bits and pieces of waste around the place. That will help. You know, you're part of a landscape. You'll feel your way through and you'll read country and it'll all work well, but all you need to do is burn it properly first. You know, don't plant trees. We don't grow trees. Country grows trees. It's as simple as that. I guess it gets back to the Tao thing you were talking about before, you know, but your symbioses start with that point of energy that you need to bring in to a stalled system. And we described it as, you know, when you start sucking petrol out of your tank.
Yeah.
With the hose.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you've got to suck it for a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And don't get too carried away and think how awesome you are because you get a bloody throat full of petrol. Just, but you give it a couple of sucks and then you get it going. And then, oh, my God, there you go. It'll just keep doing it itself. You don't have to keep sucking it out. It will suck itself out.
As always, if you're still listening, then you've hung in. And I hope that you found the second half of that interview as rewarding as I did. I actually spent 4 or 5 days with a whole lot of quiet time walking through the paddock, really deeply absorbing and thinking through his words to make sense of it all. And I wonder whether or not you will experience something similar. I particularly loved that he was quite strong in saying, I don't have the answers, but I know that stories connect us to country. Country knows the answers. Notice it and be its custodian. And I also love that he talks about living with pattern and law and the real human economy of mutual aid. It just reframes a way in which we can all exist together, but at the moment seems a bit out of our reach. As always, thanks so much to the guys from Open Door Studios who've made the sound sound schmick. And thanks to you guys who've whacked us in your ears again for another week, and for those who've tossed a few coins in our direction to keep it all ticking. You are bloody legends. Of course, we couldn't do it without our pod partners, Woof Australia and Nutrisoil. But most of all, we couldn't do it without the most amazing humans doing the most bloody incredible things. Until next week, go gently.